This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Appeal more to boys about heroes and bravery and...
I know, women hate bravery, Mike.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas P. Fordham Institute. We're at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Richard Whitmire. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Richard is the author of several books on college attainment, some of which we've discussed on this show over the years. He's also a member of the Journalism Advisory Board of The 74. And we're actually going to talk about a recent article he had on The 74. But first, let's also welcome my regular co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you with us. David's son is battling illnesses that you get when you first go to preschool or daycare. And so we're saying before the show, this almost makes things feel almost back to normal in that respect.
Yes, I don't know the name of them, and I can't distinguish one from the next, but it is strangely comforting.
You know what is not back to normal is, of course, the American education system for lots of reasons, but one of them is because of devious licks. Have you heard of this, Richard? Have you followed this story?
Devious licks?
Yes, that's the right reaction.
This is a
TikTok challenge out there on the interwebs, encouraging kids to engage in various forms of vandalism at their school and then capture it on video and post it to TikTok. The main thing is to go in and try to see what you can steal from your school. And since there's video cameras in lots of places in the schools, but not bathrooms, a lot of it has come down to things like stealing soap dispensers and in a few cases, sinks, plus anything else that's basically not bolted down. We got a note the other day from my son's middle school encouraging us to check their backpacks for anything unusual that might be there.
Almost hard to believe we have a teacher retention problem.
Oh, but the newest challenge is to slap a staff member. And so that's the latest. Yeah, no, this is exactly right. Terrible for teachers. Hey, by the way, weren't we worried that TikTok was some kind of Chinese conspiracy?
I'm still worried.
They have literally turned our students against our own schools and having our students dismantle the schools quite literally.
Well, Mike, now that you're on top of all these trends, I feel much more secure.
Oh, my goodness. But, you know, speaking of trends, we are going to talk about a trend that has been in the news lately, and that is the gender college completion trend. Let's do that on Ed Reform Update. All right. So, Richard, we've engaged in something like a pundit palooza lately over the issue of gender gaps, and more specifically, what's the matter with boys? Something you know about is you wrote a book called Why Boys Fail. I know that because on Zoom right now, I see the cover behind your head, actually, which that was nice. Thank you for that. And this all started a few weeks ago. The Wall Street Journal reported some new data from the National Student Clearinghouse saying that, you know, a growing proportion of the students on campus were women, up over 60%, that at this rate, pretty soon, within a few years, we could have 2 female college students for every 1 male college student. This is something that's been, building for many years, but seems to be exacerbated more recently. You know, and so all these people are weighing in, what's going on? What's wrong with these young men? Men are giving up on college. They're failing to launch. And you came in with a great article in the 74 saying, hold it, people, this isn't so much about what's going on. And for 18-year-olds, this starts back in elementary school. Tell us what you mean.
Well, that's what I found when I did the book, Why Boys Fail, which was my first book. And I have to say that of all 6 books, this is the one that resonates the most. This is the one that keeps coming up and coming up. You know, more and more moms and dads are worried about their sons. And I would say for good reason. They're not doing well in school. And I started off trying to figure out why these college numbers, both enrollment and graduation numbers, were looking not so good for guys. And so as any good reporter does, I followed the evidence. I followed the leads. And that took me back into elementary school, where the teachers all said, this is where it first happens. And then, you know, the real clue came when everyone started talking about their school reforms that were instituted there. All wisely, I might add, putting more students at least to be ready for college, which meant ramping up literacy skills. And what that means is, roughly speaking, they push the literacy demands down by about 2 years. A first grader was expected to do things that, 10 years earlier, a third grader would be doing. And just the way boys and girls grow up, that didn't play out so evenly when they did this, because girls are really, they pick up literacy skills quite easily, as I saw in our own daughters. And then I'd go into the school and see these boys struggling with it. Now, in years past, if you just let things proceed, the boys would catch up, roughly fourth, fifth grade, and everything would turn out fine. But the schools never adjusted to, getting tougher or more aggressive on literacy skills, and the boys suffered.
Yeah. And I think I buy a lot of this story, maybe not entirely all of it. I've got a piece in this week's Gadfly that's digging into this question as well. And I agree with your basic point. You can find this gap much earlier. A few years ago, the National Assessment Governing Board, who oversees NAEP, they came out with a college preparedness indicator for math and for reading. For reading, they basically said it's NAEP proficient, that if you hit NAEP proficient in 12th grade, that's a good predictor that you're going to graduate from college and that you're ready for college and to succeed there. And lo and behold, if you look at those data, basically look at 12th grade NAEP data in reading, for the cohort of students, the most recent cohort that's gone all the way through high school, through college, now we can look and see if they got a college degree or not. The college readiness numbers in reading and the college completion numbers match up almost identically. And the proportions in terms of male-female match up. In other words, about 56% of the college completers most recently are female, and about 56% of the kids who were proficient in reading in 12th grade were female. Go back to 8th grade, same split, 56%. Go back to 4th grade, a little better, 54%. So the boys are doing a little bit better. And I even go all the way back to the old early childhood longitudinal study where we can look at kindergarten entry. And even at kindergarten entry, you see a slight advantage for girls, as again, how we measure literacy is very different at the kindergarten level, but slight. But what they found in that study way back when, Richard, and you probably get into this in your book, is that in those first couple of years in elementary school, kindergarten, first grade, second grade especially, is when you really do see a big literacy gap open up and the girls zoom ahead. Maybe, as you say, now that we're putting higher expectations on all the kids to learn reading sooner. The other thing, interesting thing was, though, Richard, you found out that the teachers would do surveys of their students for this study. And systematically, they thought that the girls were better readers than the boys, even when that wasn't true. And the researchers think it's because the boys were more likely to misbehave, had a hard time sitting still, they were squirrely, they were little boys. And the teachers, most of whom are female, of course, would in their minds think that that meant that they actually weren't very good students or couldn't actually read, when actually on the tests, a lot of those boys could. They were showing that they were ready. And so it makes me wonder if we also have an expectations gap problem, that early elementary school teachers, they think the boys are kind of not as smart as the girls, and then the boys end up living down to those expectations. In other words, I am blaming the nation's kindergarten teachers for this college gap. What do you think, Richard? Is this it?
I think that if I were a kindergarten teacher, a first grade teacher, I'd much rather have a class full of girls than boys. There's no question about it. So in a way, I sympathize with them.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, and we have learned over the years, and a lot of people look at this on race, that we know that teacher expectations really matter, and that when you've got a teacher who believes in you, students tend to perform better. And some pretty interesting studies showing that. And that, unfortunately, in too many times, teachers have lower expectations for Black and Hispanic students. If we can erase that, then it makes a difference. There may be a same thing going on here. And it's a less sexy explanation. I mean, the media wants to talk about, the changing economy and these boys that are, But, the evidence is that we still, for the most part, we send kids who are ready for college when they're 18. They are academically well-prepared for college. Almost all of those kids in America, they go to college and they graduate from college, right? The problem is we don't have nearly enough kids who are actually ready for college at the end of 12th grade. And it turns out we have more girls than boys, more young women than young men who are ready. That's what we've got to fix.
Well, I would add something here that I heard quite often in talking to the teachers, and that is there was another thing, a phenomenon playing out at the same time, and that is that For example, math courses got a lot more verbal. There were more word problems. It wasn't worksheets so much. Science, the same thing. Working through science problems required a lot of literacy skills. And this, you can track this right through college as well, and SAT questions. And then they had an SAT writing exam for a while. And what I kept running into were these boys who really had some talent and aspiration to do something technical, you know, go into engineering, et cetera. They would show up at college and they would not be able to get through freshman lit, for example, where they had to write a lot, or anything that involved writing. And, it's a real problem.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, David, what do you think about some of these hypotheses we're floating here?
Yeah, well, they all sound plausible. I think there's definitely something to them. I do not have the same experiences that you guys have with walking into sort of elementary classrooms. James isn't there yet. And I think I'm cautious in the sense that I think there's a lot going on here, right? And the point I do agree with is it does seem pretty clear from all the data that people have put out there that something is going wrong pretty early and that it is being carried through. And I think it's going to take a long time to tease out all of the things that are happening there. I guess the other place I'm just struggling, right, is I'm just not sure what to do with all of this, right? Like, I mean, in a broader, like, moral sense, right? I mean, it seems like we're just constantly on some sort of seesaw, right? Where we got to, you know, I mean, either somebody's going to be ahead or somebody else is going to be ahead, right? And the minute we start succeeding with boys, we're going to discover that we're back to trying to fix girls again, right? I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm just struggling with how do we approach these questions in a way that doesn't make it feel like a zero-sum game? And how do we all avoid being hypocritical?
No, look, we want to root for girls to do well. It's an amazing story. Over the last several decades, it used to be, not that long ago, I mean, when I graduated from high school, there were a bunch of Gen X young women who were scoring at the college-ready level on NAEP. And many of them did not end up completing college. I mean, so that's just a huge amount of lost, you know, human potential there. So we have largely closed that gap now. That's a good thing. You know, it's amazing. I mean, we're at something like 50% now of white young women are completing four-year college degrees. I mean, that's remarkable. We have a long way to go on some of the other subgroups. And look, we should always root for, you know, the more kids learning more is a good thing, end of story. You know, but if there's evidence that we've got kids, in this case, boys, who show promise, say on tests that they can read, and then they end up faltering over time. We say, why might that be? Now, the testing thing I think is interesting. I mean, I've become convinced that those grades, kindergarten, first, second grade, so critical. Well, what do they have in common? We still don't require testing in those grades, at least under the federal apparatus. Many school districts do use something like MAP or iReady in those grades. I don't know. Should we be talking about, you know, extending the NCLB SS testing regime down to kindergarten so that we can get a handle, you know, to send the message that we've got to get a hold of this much earlier?
I'll just say very quickly, I mean, I think the other point, and perhaps this is an obvious point, but I think it bears mentioning, right, is, I mean, we're obviously in this bizarre cultural moment where, historical moment, I guess, where, you know, we've never had a female president, right? Like, the glass ceiling is still very much there. It's astounding the degree to which it still exists in 2021, right? And yet at the same time, sort of at the other end of the socioeconomic cultural spectrum, boys are getting killed, right? And so it's this just bizarre split screen effect where it seems like both sides are losing and winning at the same time, or maybe it's just losing. I don't know. I'm glad that people are talking about this finally, because I do think we have to talk about it, right? We can't let the existence of one problem mean that we don't talk about the existence of another problem. That's not how either problem gets solved.
Richard, what do you think?
Well, it is being viewed as a zero-sum game, and that's a real problem, because it doesn't have to be. I mean, K-12 schools have shown that they can make changes. And I would argue that they did so with girls who clearly were not doing so well in math and science and were not pursuing those as majors in college and were not prepared to do so. And this goes back probably 15, 20 years now, where K-12 schools really took that on. And I would argue that they've done a great job with that. If you look at AP courses taken, AP courses passed, it's huge. They've righted that one. And so I kept asking the question, Why can't you do the same with boys? I mean, there's clearly a literacy problem, a reading problem. Do the same for boys you did for girls. And the answer you get back is that it's a zero-sum game. There's a fear that it's a zero-sum game, that once you say boys have a problem and start addressing that, then there'll be less attention to the girls. And maybe they're right. Maybe schools can't do two things at once. Maybe it has to be that seesaw thing. I don't buy it, but that's the reason that nothing's getting done. And that and the fact that school leaders understandably don't want to take any more challenges. I mean, I can't imagine being a high school principal. Everything you have to deal with.
Yeah.
Why would you want to add anything to your plate?
No, that's right. That's right. But look, I think a message to kindergarten teachers, first, second grade teachers, who, again, are amazing people, salt of the earth, and say, hey, just be aware. Make sure you're not having a bias against these little boys who are all squirmy, you know, that they may be stronger readers than you think. And so if you are finding yourself, you know, where your highest reading group in your classroom is all girls, check the test scores, check the MAP scores, the iReady scores, whatever you're using. Make sure you're not overlooking some boys who are actually quite well prepared to be in those higher reading groups as well, who maybe are ready for more challenging books, who are ready to read, you know, just because they're bouncing off the walls and driving you crazy doesn't mean they can't be good readers too.
Well, when parents ask their teachers, like, you know, my boy's not doing so well in reading, what they hear back is, don't worry, he'll catch up.
Now, that is the wrong advice.
So I think it's up to parents as well to keep track of this. Don't always believe what the nice teacher says. And seek out reading on your own. As I said, there's a great site called guysread.com. It has all kinds of links to it for great reading. Parents have to take this on a bit. And as I said in the piece, you know, moms, dads, you know, you've always had this attitude, you're going to go toss a ball or football with your son and read to your daughter. And that's kind of like, that's got to equal out. So I think parents have a big responsibility here.
Yep. All right. Well said. We will leave it there. Again, Richard Whitmire, check out his piece at the 74 and hope to have you back sometime soon, Richard.
Thanks. Please do invite.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute.
Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Fascinating conversation with Richard Whitmire there about the gender gap. So, you know, as a former English teacher, high school English teacher, do you have a gender gap where the boys basically a bunch of idiots and the young women in your class actually read the books?
I'll only say that the girls enjoyed reading more than the boys. And I will have to say that the girls could write a better paragraph than those boys. The boys need a little bit more structure on the 5-paragraph essay.
Artfully put. Yeah.
Well, suppose that there was a, you know, Richard talked about some website, something like guysread.com or something. I don't know. Like, is the point that if we could get back to books that would appeal more to boys about heroes and bravery and blood and
there
guts.
It is. I know. Women hate bravery, Mike. That's been my experience.
I don't know. I can't get Megan to watch Game of Thrones. I mean,
there's so much bravery.
Well, I don't know. I haven't watched it. Is there? I'm not sure. But I do understand there's blood and guts. So.
Yes. Woo, blood and guts.
Well, Amber, what do you have for us this week?
We have some new data from RAND's American School District Panel Survey. I feel like we've got to, you know, we always get some information on, you know, what's the pandemic doing with the school systems. But this one actually focuses on remote instruction and how it may be changing relative to the pandemic. Their takeaway before I kind of get into all the nuts and bolts is that remote K-12 instruction will outlast the pandemic, some of these new forms of remote instruction. We shall see. The pandemic obviously is continually shifting, getting better, getting worse. And district leaders were surveyed a few months ago in June and early July, which sometimes already feels dated. But anyway, that's the time frame. It was earlier this summer. They surveyed roughly 300 district leaders and weighted their responses to make them nationally representative. The districts are part of this RAND's American District Panel. This particular sample included 15 leaders from CMOs, so they aren't broken out. They can't look at CMOs separately. RAND, it's a short report. RAND says we're only presenting statistically significant findings and results, and so here are some of them. As of, again, June, early July, Virtually all of their nationally representative sample of districts, that's 97%, plan to offer fully in-person instruction in fall 2021. Obviously, a marked increase from the end of 2021 school year when federal data indicated that about 7 in 10 districts were offering in-person to some or all students. Just 14% of surveyed districts plan to offer some type of temporary, partial, or fully remote option to at least some of their students in fall 2021. RAND says this low percentage reflects the growing concerns throughout the 2021 school year that remote learning students were falling further behind their peers who received in-person instruction. And then they also explain that, you know, there are at least 25 states now that have a mandate for in-person instruction in fall 21. So that also depressed some of those numbers. About 1/3 of urban districts, compared with 1/10 of suburban and rural districts, plan to offer some type of temporary remote option in fall 2021. Urban districts were also more likely than their suburban and rural counterparts to provide fully remote instruction during the 2021 school year. I think we've heard that before. Then they focus on this subset of 39 districts in their sample that plan to offer both fully remote and fully in-person instruction in fall 2021. And then they asked those leaders of those districts, you know, what do you think is going to be the take-up on your fully remote option? Just a guesstimate. Leaders expected a small minority, just 6% of students on average, to elect to take this fully remote option. And the remainder they thought would elect the in-person option, I guess, just from their read of their district. 21% of all surveyed district leaders said parents had, quote, strongly demanded a remote schooling option for 21-22. Surprisingly, that perceived parental demand was not strongest in urban districts, and they thought, well, perhaps because they'd already decided to offer remote schooling. We know that urbans were more likely to offer remote options during the pandemic already. And then according to these same district leaders, they also had some data where they compared the RAND data to some data in the Common Core data set. And they found that only 3% of their districts ran a virtual school before the pandemic. Since the pandemic began, however, the number of districts running virtual schools has grown ninefold, according to RAND's latest data. Specifically, 26% of district leaders reported that their districts plan to run one or more virtual schools in the 21-22 school year. But then there's this discussion where RAND says, you know what, we actually think this growth is overestimated since they were looking at the open-ended responses and some of the leaders were saying that their district didn't allow them to run a virtual school. They also had some issues triangulating the RAND survey data with the federal Common Core data. So they're not exactly sure where that 26% is completely accurate, but where they come down is still many more students are going to be accessing virtual schools in 2021 than before the pandemic, even though we can't quantify it super precisely. And then the last part, they asked the schools about fully online courses, and they found that most of the districts had already offered them before the pandemic, so they didn't see a big growth of fully online courses with the pandemic. And they were already used before the pandemic for credit recovery. They find that that's how they're using them now. And then they basically say that growth in virtual schools is greatest among urban districts. Again, where I think I already said this, about half reported plans to run a virtual school. And then they close with a warning that there's going to be and is a rise in virtual school enrollment. And it means we need to be paying attention to quality and oversight, given what past research has found about virtual schools.
Okay. Well, you know, like you said, Amber, this does a little bit feel like ancient history already. It makes me hope that the RAND folks will go back to these leaders and ask them how it turned out. You know, this was before the Delta wave was clear about how bad it is and was and is. And also just, man, I mean, there are all kinds of fights going on right now still about trying to get some of these districts to offer more remote learning options. You've got parents who are striking. You know, you've got politicians angry at school districts in D.C. right now. The city council, D.C. council, trying to force the school system to offer a remote learning option. You know, many of our friends in the reform world, you know, think that, of course, that parents want the option, they should get it. I personally have still been Mr. Paternalism. Think that, look, by forcing people to send their kids back to school, the kids are learning more, almost surely. And so that's what we should be doing. I don't know.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Mike. You know, I do. I just feel like the data are pretty overwhelming in terms of in-person versus not, and that we should still be reserving it to kids who really need that option.
Yeah.
Okay, but then help me out, guys. You're both for homeschooling, though, right?
We are for homeschooling, but I'm also for universal attendance laws, right? I mean, look, I will say on the homeschooling front, you know, this whole experience has probably made me a little bit, you know, more of a, I don't know, a hawk on having some reasonable requirements. I mean, in other words, I do think parents should have to demonstrate that they actually are educating their kid, you know, and so.
Hey, we agree.
I think there are some states where there's really not much to that. You know, it shouldn't be onerous, and there should, you know, again, we should be very open to parents doing it the way they see best, but, mm-hmm. you know, we should make sure that it's happening.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just getting more and more curious about, you know, there have been a couple pieces about this blurring of the lines between these two worlds, right? I mean, if you've got whatever it is, a ninefold increase, okay, maybe that's overstated, but, you know, some multiple increase of exponential increase of districts offering remote instruction. You know, on the one hand, we've been talking about how the rise in homeschooling is overstated, but we could also be bringing homeschooling parents back into the system somehow, right? I don't know how we're going to get to the bottom of it, right? Mm-hmm. But we're going to need to start to measure this a little bit differently, because right now, I can't tell at all who we're talking about here or why. It seems to me that it should be one category that includes people, anyone who isn't physically sending their kid to school, basically. Maybe that's wrong. But I guess, you know, we can't say with any sort of certainty that homeschooling parents aren't using resources provided by these places. And presumably they're providing some supports to kids who are. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, look, where I do agree with some of the reformers, our friends, is they surely should have been prepared for the quarantine issue. Right. I mean, even if you didn't think Delta was going to hit us as badly, you still had to expect that there were going to be kids testing positive and, you know, you were going to have more kids out sick for longer than normal. So the fact that so many districts haven't planned on that, you know, so again, full time remote. OK, we want to move past that. But what does the kid do when they're at home? And can we at least turn the cameras back on so they can follow along from home, you know, again, without the expectation maybe that the teacher has to engage them much, but just better than nothing.
Right.
And I guess I'm also just curious to know what, I mean, I'm not entirely sure as I'm thinking about it more that I know what it means for a remote option, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that, what should I be picturing there? Is it literally like, does that mean that they're zooming into their classrooms?
Yeah, last year.
I mean, are we sure though?
Well, I think, you know, hopefully in some of these places, they did try to actually build an online school where there was, you know, live instruction and it felt more like school than, you know, versus like busy work that they did at their own pace.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering if we really know as I'm thinking about it more.
But look, I will keep advocating that we do want to have the cameras on for the kids that are homesick into perpetuity. Again, just so they can, better than nothing, the teachers don't have to feel like they have to pay attention to them. You know, so for example, let's just say hypothetically, an elementary school child comes down with head lice. Hypothetically, right. Let's say, not that I know anything about this experience right now, and maybe hypothetically spent the day today at home. You know, so other than enjoying himself hypothetically by, I don't know, watching screens, said child could be watching math class. That's all I'm asking. Lice, people.
Oh, man.
Lice. That's what you got to look forward to, David. Lice.
Fortunately, we're both immune.
Out. I'm scratching my head already. Eesh.
If you see me with a shaved head next week, you're going to know what happened. Okay.
Right.
On that.
We went down a separate path.
On that disturbing a topic. Yes, I know. Everybody scratch your head out there. That's right. It happens. Lice happens, people. Hey, that is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.